request that you take your seat as we are about to begin shortly. Before we start the proceedings for today, I would like to make a few housekeeping announcements. All participants, kindly ensure that you switch off all sound emitting devices or turn them on silent mode. Washrooms are located at the center core dining area. All guests are entitled to enjoy the free flow of cuisine in the center core dining area, which serves breakfast, coffee breaks, and lunch. Smoking area is located at the park next to this building. To get there, you may take the bubble lift to ground floor. For any other queries or assistance, please seek help from the MASB Secretariat in Red Lanyard. Good morning, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Kuala Lumpur Convention Center and to the IASB-FASB Roundtable Meeting on Revenue Recognition. We will commence our event with welcome remarks by the Chairman of Malaysian Accounting Standards Board, Encik Muhammad Faiz Azmi.
Good morning. This is quite an interesting time to come to KL. If you notice, today is actually really our first ISB-FASB roundtable in Malaysia. And I think we've had a series of firsts over the last year. Today is also, the start of the World Congress of Accountants, which I gather has currently now 5,977 members signed up. So if 23 of you would like to join, I'm sure the WCO will be very grateful of your registration. But anyway, just adding on to the comments, welcome to Kuala Lumpur. Welcome to this very important meeting. You'll see from the timetable that actually we have quite a lot to try and cover this morning. And certainly from our perspective, we would like to welcome Tatsuya Yamada from ISB, Paul Pachter, and also the project manager, Henry Rees. And very unusually, we actually have a representative from FASB, Sri Prasad Kadambi, who's sitting right at the end there. What's the purpose of this roundtable? Well, basically, it's to discuss a few issues relating to the revenue standard. But also at the same time, it's important to try and give feedback to these gentlemen as to what are the, shall we say, areas that need clarification, or also those concerns that we may still have. Finally, I noticed from the delegate list that we've actually got visitors from Korea, India, Japan, Hong Kong, and Singapore. So welcome again. And as I said, if you're short of anything to do, there is the World Congress of Accountants. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Faiz. So, we are so much delighted to come here, and also that we are very pleased to have a lot of people to attend this roundtable discussion on revenue recognition. So, and we would like to start the discussions. So, and before I start, I think that this is a joint roundtables together with ISB and FASB, but unfortunately there's no board member attended from FASB, so and I think that Prasada, you must have a message from the FASB board members.
Thank you, Tatsumi. I would like to take this opportunity to thank all participants for their interest and participation in this roundtable, as Tatsumi mentioned, as the birds, the FASB bird is very tied up on various projects, trying to and working on all the MOU projects in an effort to improve accounting standards for global convergence. And they're very much interested in your feedback today, so I'm going to gather your input and any feedback on this project, and I would be sure to relay that message along to the FASB board. Thank you again for participating in this roundtable.
Okay, Prasad, thank you very much. So I think that before we start the discussions, I have to tell you that this discussion will be recorded, and it will be available from our website. So when you make your presentation or your address, you must be very clear in your views and also press the button. That is very important. Right, so before starting, so I would like to ask you to make your introduction of yourself. Right, so from here, say, my name is Tatsumi Yamada of the ISB. So then Paul.
I'm Paul Pachter, member of the IASB also.
Faiz Azmi, MASB chairman.
Good morning. I'm Song Soo Kwan from Korean Accounting Standard Board. I'm technical director.
Catherine Morley. I'm based in Hong Kong, but I'm here representing KPMG International in the region.
Good morning. I'm Bee Ling from the Malaysian Accounting Standards Board.
Hi, I'm Liu Kim Yun, representing the Securities Commission of Malaysia.
I'm Millie from the MASB. I'm Shuyen, representing the Real Estate Housing Developers Association.
I'm Lee Chun, representing the Financial Reporting Foundation, Malaysia.
Hi, I'm Swat Ching, representing Singapore Accounting Standards Council.
I'm M. Jojo, Accounting Standards Board of Japan.
My name is Bongwan Kaur, Korean the Dairy Industrial Company, come from Korea. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, I'm Jung Soo Han, a professor of Ewha Women's University, representing Korean Accounting Association.
I'm from Samsung Construction. My name is Yong Ho Son.
I'm Kim from Deloitte International.
I'm Chiang Tung Fan, representing Financial Reporting Foundation, Malaysia.
Tada Sikkar, International Public Sector Accounting Standards Board, who sets the international accounting standards for government and other public sector entities.
Prasad Kadambi, Financial Accounting Standards Board.
Henry Rees, from the ISB staff.
Okay, so thank you very much. So I think that you have already got this paper. So and I would like to get into the topic one. It's a control. I think you have already read the point. And so without any explanation, I would like to get into the discussion directory. So do you have any views on this control issues? Oh, yes, please.
Sorry. I think it's very good work and desirable that the exposure draft has unified the control model and the risk and rewards model. The single model seems to be consistent with the conceptual framework and the definition of assets and the recognition. It's very logical. However, I think applying the single model practically has some limitations of reflecting various transaction substance. Thus, I'd like to suggest or propose that the exposure draft be supplemented with some indicators or some points. I think continuous transfer is what the most people concern in Korea. Our concern is that there would be a change in revenue recognition by the exposure draft. That is, some companies could not apply that percentage of completion method any longer.
Although the expert draft describes that there will be no change in many cases, but the constituents don't think so. That's a problem. So there needs to be a clarification of accounting completion method of is so there needs to be a clarification of accounting continuity from the existing to the new accounting method in order to relieve such a concern. Under the export draft, the extant percentage of completion method is articulated, I think, as a continuous transfer. The changing notion to continuous transfer causes ambiguities, especially in service and construction industry. Many Korean constituents regard that it would be very difficult to apply continuous transfer according to the ED instead of current percentage of completion method. The result would decrease the usefulness of information. We believe sufficient indicators and examples are needed regarding controls continuous transfer. So, and can I have more time?
Yes, please. You're covering a lot of things. So.
Sorry. I'd like to suggest to add an indicator for non-cancelable contracts. Non-cancelable contracts. It is similar to firm commitment in the IAS 39. I think to enhance the practicability of the exposure drafts control model, clarifying indicators should be developed more. One of them, I think, is that the non-cancelable contracts, in another saying, as a firm commitment, control is always, in that case, transferred continuously to customers according to seller's activities based on the contracts. Especially such contracts as construction, real estate, have more features to show continuous transfer of control during construction activities. So according to the exposure draft, such cases as non-cancelable contracts can be applied by the existing percentage of completion method.
So, say, you can say some more things later, but I think it's better to stop here right now. So, and say, I have a response or question. So, you said the single model has some limitation, and you require some more explanation or some guidance, but. It seems to me, after having what you have said, I think that still you support the single model, but more explanation or some guidance in some different aspect of the single model is required. My understanding is correct, or do you, what you have said in your mind is still we must have more than single model? It's not clear to me on that point.
I think a single model is very, very good. To apply consistently. But the single model has the limitations in terms of very difficulty in judgment and in difficulty in assessment of whether the control is transferred to the buyer. That's the problem. So I think there need more indicators to make it easier to judge. Yeah.
Paul, please.
Thanks. I would like to ask about your suggestion of adding an indicator that the contract is not cancelable. I understand that, and actually one of our principles is that the customer has an unconditional obligation to pay. But if you add as an indicator that the contract is not cancelable, how does that lead to continuous recognition over the life of the contract, as opposed to recognize the whole thing up front? Why does non-cancelable make it recognition of revenue over the life of the contract and not one time? That's my question.
I think the substance is the same, but how can we see that reality, that the substance is very difficult to standards, which indicators will be applied. I mean, the non-cancelable contracts, and if with the progress payment, in that situation, the seller's activities mean the continuous transfer of control, because it is non-cancelable, and the buyers should pay with the percentage of the construction that is progress payment. Yeah. So I think that's not different from control model. Yeah.
I think that he covered a lot of things, and you must have a lot of reactions, I think. Yes, please.
I just want to, you know, add what Mr. Guan said about the non-cancelable contracts. I think that the non-cancelable contracts and the unconditional payments means the same thing. They are not much difference at all. Those two things means that the customer takes the responsibility of paying the amounts, which means that the risk and rewards or the control is transferred to the customer. So in that sense, I think that is a good idea. But what we are worrying about is that unconditional sometimes means too strong, you know, the meaning. Unconditional sometimes means that, you know, it cannot be canceled at all, no matter what happens. But unconditional, I mean, that, you know, the non-cancelable, we have some definition of it, like non-cancelable contracts in the lease. So we have some kind of, you know, predetermined the definition of it. So that if we use, I mean, change the wording from unconditional to non-cancelable, it can make more sense to many people. I think that is what he's trying to say.
Thank you. So, and Amy?
Sorry. I agree to add indicators because it's difficult to assess the customer has ability to direct use of work in progress. So I suggest to add indicator that the case that the customer has an obligation to pay for the progress in the date in case it cancels the contract.
But what do you think about the raised by Paul? That means if it is non-cancelable, so rather than recognize that as time goes by, you should recognize everything at the inception because it is non-cancelable. That is a question raised by Paul. So what do you think about that?
In that case, if entity has have a prompt fee, but it doesn't make the goods or services. It hasn't made goods and services. So it's still. I prefer to transfer continuously.
So, say from staff, do you have some clarification questions?
No, I just. Basically, what you're saying is that we need to have a stronger link there in the indicators to say that when the entity has rights to consideration in full for the work that it's performed to date, that would be a very strong indicator that essentially that something has transferred from the entity to the customer, and therefore that revenue recognition would be appropriate. And I think that's quite a consistent theme that we've heard and seen in the comment letters. And I think that seems to also have sort of application when we talk about the specific issue here of retail real estate transactions in the jurisdictions around here.
May I just ask a question? You know, before we get fixated on indicators, perhaps we should take one step backwards and work out the principles, because we, you know, have just had an entire year of some very, very distressing arguments to try to justify the percentage of completion method, which we feel represents the economic substance of our business and what happens in this country. You have it in the various comment letters. I think the difficulty is that when we looked at IFRIC 15 at the start, we were basically informed that, you know, although it seemed to open the route and still permit percentage of completion, most of the firms were saying at the outset that you can forget it. It's so remote as not to be there. It may as well not be there. So I think before we get fixated on indicators, could we have an affirmation that instead it's not really a one model. It's basically two methods of accounting. It's either point in time or it's percentage of completion. If the percentage of completion is still a valid method of accounting, and that seems to be supported in the basis of conclusions. I remember reading in paragraphs, I think it was 65 or 66, something like that, where a lot of concern was expressed about whether percentage for completion would still be permitted, that you know, I think the board said yes. So if that is the case, then can we have a very clear affirmation that the percentage of completion still makes sense, and perhaps a low threshold example of when it can be applied? Because, you see, in the case of the construction industry, the only example that we see is example 17, which is so obvious that it is a point in sale. You know, I mean, a point of time upon completion. But it is not real to our experience, because, firstly, when you're talking about mass housing, which still happens a lot in developing nations, you would almost never have a situation where people can dictate, you know, the design of the product. It is mass housing after all. But the percentage for completion has been used for a long time, and it has resulted in useful information. So again, you know, perhaps some stronger affirmations on the usability of that, and also, you know, maybe more substance to the overall words of the new revenue standard, which seems to suggest that substance is important and not just form, that, you know, simplicity and relevance is still not something that we want to throw out of the window, because as the conversations progress, it gets increasingly worrisome that at the end of the day, you will end up with a set of, you know, accounts that are the size of a telephone book, which no one will use and hardly anyone will understand.
Can I just respond? I can't stop saying, because you were talking about percentage of completion under IS 11. That notion is totally different from what we are proposing, because the percentage of completion, as you know, it just focuses on the existence of the contract, and if you can measure the cost you spend, so then based on the cost you spend, you can recognize a sort of the corresponding revenue. So that notion is totally different from what is proposed by the exposure draft, because the exposure draft is just focused on whether control over the goods is transferred to the customer or not. The line of thinking is so different. So one of the reasons raised by the friends is, say, he's suffering from the continuous transfer notion, but say, if we would like to be consistent, we would like to stick to the control notion and whether control has been passed to the client continuously or not. So but my question is, by saying percentage completion should be retained, so you would like to have the two different models? That means based on the current IS 11, or still you like to think that the continuous transfer notion should be followed, but it should be refined in some way. What is your intention of saying that to keep the percentage of completion?
I think as long as, because when I say percentage of completion, I'm not talking about percentage of completion in the IAS 11 framework, but just I'm trying to look at the end result. At the end result, are we saying that, you know, you can only recognize something when everything has been completed, irrespective of whether it takes 5 years to complete? Or are we saying that in circumstances where something is going to run through multiple accounting periods, that the percentage of completion method still makes sense? If we are saying the latter, then the path towards percentage of completion should be made clearer and easier. And if it's all encapsulated in one standard, I think that it has value, because then you just look at the one standard instead of trying to work out between the two. But it doesn't come across clearly enough. As we read through the indicators, the tendency is, you know, to move towards completion. And if that's the case, then, you know, it is really denying users of accounting standards some very useful information.
So, Prasada.
One thing I'll be interested is in the U.S. today, the current real estate guidance for real estate says uses similar to a percentage of completion, and the economics of some of the transactions are basically in a multiplex home. You might be selling a legal deed at an outset, and then there are progress payments throughout, and at the end of the day, you get certificate of occupancy when I move in to my building. So I would like to understand what are the economics over here in this region to see whether we could get to a continuous transfer.
Tom Fon, do you want to say? No? Okay. So, yeah, I thought you raised hand, but okay. So Tadashi, please.
I suppose that the single basis and also strongly support the RSP very principle-based accounting standard setting. So generally, but when I hear the voice of the round table, I think the board's intention is allow the continuously current practice of percentage completion accounting. But if we read the actual text of the board proposed, is somehow the people feel that it's quite could be narrowly interpreted in the case of where the such accounting is allowed. I'm particularly have slightly concerned about the unconditional payments. If I understand correctly, and conditional payments is that somehow the customer have to pay at a fixed date in the contract. But I think that it may be substantially narrowed from such accounting, and in my opinion, it does not. It's something towards to the rather the form of the contract rather than the substance of the contract. I think we have the proposed and proposed standards should look at that. What would be happened if the contract is cancelled or the construction engagement cannot be finished in some reasons? In the most construction contract, that something happened like the bankruptcy of the sellers or something, and the force measures, they can settle with based on the percentage of completion at that time. So that if the contract cannot finish in some reasons, what would happen? It is the most important thing to the as far as the payment in that question. Rather than marry that the payment is at the fixed date is unconditional or not.
Yes, please. So then,
I'm in charge of accounting the construction company, so So I'm in charge of the accounting section, so a construction company. So I want to tell you about the construction industry, regarding this, the customer-specific design, and the physical control, and the transport control. Three kind of I'll explain. So on the construction steps is basically explain. Okay? Okay, let me time. The construction industry is dedicated to the building long-term project. And the subsequently transferring those product to customer consumers. However, I believe that the current exposure draft does not adequately represent the characteristics of the real estate industry. The construction industry is very different from the manufacturing industry. And thus, I cannot agree with the proposal designed to provide a standard procedure that would accommodate the revenue recognition procedure of both industry. I would like to first talk about customer-specific design. Some professionals argue that according to the ED, the completed contract method should be used for apartment complex project initiated by private construction companies because the construction company make a development plans before the contract is sold. Since the contract are pre-sold, the customers cannot specify the design and request for the structural changes. Also, the government imposes strict restrictions on structural changes for safety reasons. Nevertheless, a builder must contract a specific apartment for the specific customer. For example, house 401 of building A would be picked by the customer for specific reasons such as location and so forth. This house 401 of building A is not replaceable. To my opinion, this is customer specific. Therefore, I think that this indicator is not an appropriate criterion for determining whether the percentage of completion method can be used. I cannot understand how the subject of design can be an indicator in determining accounting practice of apartment construction, especially under heavy government regulation. Regarding the physical control, in Korea, when construction of apartment complex, the only right of the builder to receive a deposit and its accompanying progress payment, the obligation is to deliver the apartment to the customer. As stipulated in the contract, once a contract is entered into, the builder does not have any discretionary power to change anything and must execute the contract accordingly. We must complete the construction in line with the directions specified by the customer and deliver it within the time frame given in the contract. This shows that the builder does not have physical control over the work in progress, as all it can do is follow the orders of the contract. Transport control. In addition, in terms of control in a long-term apartment complex project, the contract is non-cancelable. The customer makes progress payment according to development schedule, and the customer retains the right to exercise property right, such as ownership right, which shows transport risk and moreover control. In a nutshell, regarding customer-specific design, physical possession, and the transfer of control, the percentage of completion method should be applied to long-term apartment complex construction in order to better portray the economic substance and the real practice of the industry. So I propose then more effective indicator and example that use the percentage of completion method should be added to the ED. This would reflect the economic substance of the construction industry by enabling the use of a practical revenue recognition model. Thank you. My English not excellent, sorry.
No, yeah, good. Thank you very much. So, and Paul?
Almost every letter that people around the table wrote start out saying, we agree with the board that transfer of control should be the principle for revenue recognition. And the issue, it seemed to me, for construction contract, if you think percentage of completion is the correct answer, is to demonstrate, to explain to us how control transfers continuously over the life of the contract. The old percentage of completion under IAS 11 was not based on transfer of control, but passing of time. The title of IAS 11 is long-term contract. And so if the contract take more than a year, we say because it's long-term, use percentage of completion. But if you accept transfer of control is revenue recognition, not passing of time, could all, as many of you as possible, explain to us how control transfers continuously. I've heard people say three things. One, progress payments. If you make progress payment over the life of the contract, what we on the board worry about with progress payment is structuring of revenue recognition. You just, in the contract, you decide when the progress payment is made, and so you can decide when revenue is picked up, and that's a problem. I heard one or two people say ability of the customer to sell during the construction period. And maybe this is a good one, but maybe we need to add that in. And the third one I heard was the customer specifications, built to customer specifications. So what I'm asking, and I think it's the same as Tatsumi point out in when his comment on IAS 11 and Prasad, who said, well, what's the underlying economics to demonstrate that control transfer over the life of the contract? And I welcome people's views on that. Thanks, okay. Tatsumi.
Yeah. Okay, so.
As you said, all of the letters around the table came in. Sorry.
I said be them, okay, Catherine, please.
The letters that people have written in, I think, start off with an idea of general support of a revenue recognition project, of moving away from having two standards to having one standard. And I think the colleague down the table from the Real Estate Development Association, I think, really hit the nail on the head from the company's point of view of can we get some sort of clarity moving forward? So there's an underlying sense there. In terms of actually in the standard where the problems are coming is this disconnect between transfer of control description of being able to use the asset and the indicators. And I thought it was very interesting that Paul described one of the indicators as being a principle, where he mentioned that looking at the unconditional obligation to pay was a principle in the standard. And this is exactly where we've had the problem, because it's not actually a principle, it's one of the indicators. And it doesn't fit. I mean, if you took this to its absolute purest, it would seem to mean physical transfer. And in terms of a five-year property development project, physical transfer is not there. And in IFRIC 15, we had a paragraph that told us that physical transfer was not the be-all and end-all of revenue recognition. So this is where we're coming from. And some of this issue is when you ask us to explain what does continuous transfer mean, I think it's it's really to throw it back and say it was your term, you used it, we're struggling to apply it, is essentially how it's working. But we're not really quite sure what you mean by continuous transfer, but when we look at the discussions, we think you mean that in circumstances where you really have a buyer on the hook, they're involved in the project, if the developer goes bust, they're left with a half-built building, that in that situation it would be appropriate to recognise revenue. And I think the comment from the representative from FASB was very interesting to bring in what are actually the economics in the different local jurisdictions, because they do vary considerably, and that is what's coming through, and to make sure that somehow in the standard there's an acknowledgement of what actually makes a difference and it not being physical transfer.
Thank you, Catherine. So we realize that, say, our notion, this performance obligation works for the normal goods sales, but in the case of the construction, it doesn't work well. So we need some solutions. And one of the reasons why we ask you this kind of meeting is we would like to hear from you the sort of the solutions, how to deal with this troubles. So, Bilen, please.
I have 3 points. The first one is on indicators. I've heard just now many say maybe you want to add on one more indicators. But the problem, as the ED is being drafted now, it's well and fine you give the 4 indicators. But what happened in situation where you have inconsistent indicators or conflicting indicators? And I think there should be a paragraph that brings back to say, in the event of this, then perhaps the underlying principle that the ability to sell or pledge should be the underlying. Because for a construction industry, of course, you can't have physical possession. Neither do you want to go into the half-built property. So perhaps for the indicators, you should say, these are the indicators. They are not the underlying principle. But if you have conflicting indicators, can you please go back to the main principle that is, for example, ability to sell or pledge. And my second point is the notion of continuous transfer. Well, I think what we need is more explanation from the ISB. How do you apply that notion to a real estate industry? It's something new, and I think, you see, when in the real estate industry, the problem is, how can I have continuous transfer when I don't even have the property? And I think, Henry, your paragraph B64, which talk about the work in progress, where you can actually transfer work in progress, may be a good example, and that may bring it to the main standard. And another point is on the examples. Although examples are meant for examples only and not the main principle, but unfortunately, because you have only one example for this big industry, and this example is like, I think it's a very clear-cut example that you should apply the completed method. So perhaps if you feel that the notion of transfer of control can work for the real estate industry, I think that should be an example to demonstrate how it could work for a real estate industry, the notion of continuous transfer. Perhaps an Asian example will be good to be included in the final standard. Thank you.
So, Dr. Yap Kim?
Well, what the rest of the delegates have said, because I share their views one way or the other, and I could also understand from the ISB point of view and from the FASB point of view that you guys have quite a difficult task at hand. However, just to answer Paul's questions, that to get some potential solutions to how to prove the transfer during the continuous stage, I think I'm not going to say whether I support the control principle or not. However, control principle would work rather well if there is an irrevocable right has been to consideration established at each stage of the performance being fulfilled. And that is where it is a proof to satisfy the definition of so-called your asset, that you have a control. So as long as the irrevocable right to consideration is established, I think whether you use control principle or not, explicitly use the word control, it's understood because it's embedded in the so-called the common meaning of control. I wanted to say one more thing. The problem with the terminology used in the control notion is that it has been a common understanding, say, Paul, pardon me, that the control is passing of physical delivery of goods. And that is the understanding commonly used, okay? So that is, I think the perception needs to be clear. And this is the, we actually urge the ISB board to really to clarify that so-called notion. Perhaps do not use such a hardcore word, control, but use some much more natural meaning. As Deloitte International wrote to ISB, also urges that the board to consider rather than use a hardcore word. So I think I echo also Billing's view about the indicators, because we are talking about coming up with a unilateral recognition principle for so many different industries. And I can share the people in the construction industry that will actually create a lot of volatile so-called performance indicators for them. And it is no good to the equity market, okay? And it affects eventually every stakeholder. So that is my answer to Paul's question about how to prove the control being passed on the continuous basis.
Thank you. And Henry?
Yes, no. I just wanted to sort of emphasize that and reassure everybody here that I guess that the principle that we're trying to articulate is that you recognize revenue because there's been a transfer of goods and services, transfer of value from the company to its customer. And we use control as just as the means of sort of figuring out has that transfer actually taken place. But the principle really is transfer. And I think what I'm hearing here and have read in these comment letters is I think the thing that is perhaps most difficult about the control principle as we've articulated it so far is the direct the use of piece, because that's very difficult to reconcile with a construction type contract, because it's just in the ordinary sense of the word, it's quite hard to sort of see how you direct the use of a part completed asset, and so it seems to throw you towards the completed contract. So I think that's a bit that we need to look at quite carefully, and perhaps there's a different way of articulating the transfer principle without actually necessarily using the control, and so we can certainly look at, is a better way of doing this to perhaps try and distinguish between the goods and the services, and therefore, and then split it between goods and services and have different and different indicators for those. Or as some have suggested, I think, is are there different indicators required for continuous delivery type contracts? So that's something that we will definitely look at quite carefully. When it comes to the real estate examples, the customer specific design aspect, that's I think is a real issue here, because we certainly didn't intend by that indicator that the asset had to be built to the customer's specified design, and if it wasn't, that you couldn't have continuous delivery. That's not what we intended. But I was trying to think about what's the discriminating feature of these retail real estate contracts between, say, a contract in the UK, which is very much like example 17 in the ED, where I think most people would say that is a completed contract, and an example over here, whereby, and it seemed to me that some of the key differences were some of the features that have been raised this morning, which was not, it's nothing really to do with the customer design. It's all to do with the fact that the customer's making these progress payments and the customer has the right to pledge to resell the asset. And so that seems to be the key discriminatory factors between those two types of contracts and why perhaps there's different revenue recognition. But Could I ask one question, which is, it links to IFRIC 15, which does have this notion of continuous transfer, continuous delivery. So even if the contract doesn't meet the definition of a construction contract, IFRIC 15 said that you could effectively meet the criteria for sale of goods continuously and therefore get a continuous revenue recognition pattern, and that would be very much similar to what you would have got in under IS 11. So what is the stumbling block with the retail real estate contracts in the jurisdictions here today that you have difficulty about meeting those criteria on a continuous basis and therefore that you don't get continuous revenue recognition?
I think if...
I'll ask the Korean colleague to start first.
Okay, thank you. I have to thank you to Henry for mentioning about the difficulties of understanding what directing the use of. I actually wanted to mention about that, but you already mentioned, so that I don't want to say about it. But you know, in construction, for example, you know, sometimes, I mean, first of all, I have to point out that the ED says the revenue should be recognized when the customer has the control. But in many cases, the customer does not have the control, or the seller has the control. So neither party has the control. So for example, in Korea, usually when the contract is made, customer has the control. They have the ownership, they can exercise the ownership, for example. But government sometimes, you know, they impose some limitations onto the customer's exercise of their rights. So in that case, neither parties, sellers or buyers, do not have any controls at all. Then in that case, what do we have to do? In most of the cases, sellers do not and cannot exercise any their rights in the property at all. Means that the control is not on the seller's side at all. But still, based on the ED, you know, the seller, the construction company, cannot recognize any revenue. So that kind of problem exists in Korea. And also I want to add up a few more things, like the examples. Since you mentioned the example 17, when we read 17, what we, you know, the feel was that the 17 does not say anything about the principles. The 17 says only about the indicators, how to apply the indicators. It doesn't say why indicators are so important in that example. It doesn't say anything about why that indicators are important in the principles. So sometimes the readers can be misguided by that. Meaning that readers can say that indicators are kind of decisive or the final things we have to think. So that I think that the example should be rewritten so that we can understand what is the principle instead of what is the indicators. And the second one I want to say about the example is that, you know, some of the example, since you mentioned 17, example 17 just says about the usage of the complete contract method. But it doesn't say anything about the conditions where we can use the percentage completion method. So it's kind of confusing for us. Sometimes some people says that ED supports only the completed contract method. It does not support the percentage completion method. So that I suggest you include both the example and the counter example so that we can understand what is the difference of those two and what is the principles we have to use. And last one, you know, the poll says about the progress payments. And progress payments doesn't seem to be the indicators for the continuous transfer of control. Actually, when we mention the progress payments, we mean the non-cancelable progress payments. When we mentioned that, what we assumed was that unconditional or the non-cancelable progress payments should be made based on the percentage of completion. So that doesn't exclude the percentage of completion or the seller's obligation. Seller has to do their obligation. And then customer has to have their obligations. In that sense, both of those two is going to be matched, so that we can recognize the transfer of control.
Just clarification. So the non-refundable progress payment paid by the customers, and if the constructor goes bankrupt, so what would happen? So some other legal system will help the customer?
Actually, in Korea, we have that kind of system. We have a government-made insurance company. So they backed up all the constructions.
for more than 20 houses. So that if any construction company wants to make any construction projects for more than 20 houses, that insurance company get involved in the process. So that if the seller goes bankrupt, then the insurance company covers all the losses so that they can find a contractor for the construction. So the construction can be completed backed by the insurance company. So in that sense, you know, there is no difficulties in recognizing the percentage of completion method, I think, at least in Korea.
Okay, yeah, so, Henry.
Well, just one question. We've spoken about the bankruptcy there. What happens if the construction is progressing according to plan, the customer has made some progress payments? What happens if the customer wants to cancel the contract?
Are you asking about Korea case, by example?
Yeah.
It's extremely difficult. They can do it, but you know, at least 4/5, am I right? As soon as the deposit is made, they can cancel it. But once they make the first payment, there should be an agreement among the customers. At least 4/5 of the customers should agree with the cancellation of the contracts. Otherwise, the construction should go on. So that it's almost impossible. What I meant by that is that, in most of the construction contracts in Korea, some of the construction involves more than 100, more than 500, sometimes 10,000, 1,000. The customers, they cannot agree together in canceling the contract. So that contract is almost, I should say, impossible to be canceled.
Is that after the first payment?
First payment, yes.
What is the percentage of amount is based on the deposit and the first payment based on the property selling price?
I think that is because of the legal issues.
My question is what is the percentage of the amount? Say the deposit is, say, 5% on sale price. The first payment is, say, another 5%. Is it 10%?
I do not know the details, so I just asked the construction company managers, and what they told me is that the first deposit is 10%. And about 10 to 20% of the construction is completed, the customer usually pays the first payment.
Is there any financing by the seller or financing by the subsidiary of the seller in the property?
No, buyer.
And the financing is through, is not the financer of the property, is nothing to related to the seller.
Well, there is some difference between the United States and Korea. United States, usually the deposit is a kind of subscription system. The deposits are going to the escrow account. But in Korea, it's very different. In Korea, the payments from the customers is used for the construction. So that, the construction company has to have their own financing system also. But customers' payment is not a separate account. Customers' payment is also spent for the construction. So is that the proper answer to your question?
Yeah, it clarifies. My reason why I asked the percentage was to see whether the contract itself is an option or not. That was the reason behind I was asking the question.
Construction is a...
There's no enough cash payment upfront by the customer, then I can walk away from the deal because that payment could be like an option.
Oh, I don't think that's almost impossible in Korea.
Okay.
For protecting the customers, the government heavily involved in the construction. I think... That's the same in Malaysia and other countries also. In Korea, apartment building takes about 90%, more than 90% of the whole housing in Korea. So that in nowadays, about 95% of the new constructions are the apartment buildings. And also, the apartments are very expensive in Korea, so the government has a very heavy regulation on the construction of Korea. That's why I said that there are lots of cases when neither the seller or buyer has the control over the work in progress in many cases.
So
Yeah, thank you very much. So I have a question to staff. So do you want to clarify each individual country's situations? The trouble of this real estate transaction or construction is that it depends on the country, and also it's closely related to the sort of the protection and how to give the government to the government. Government would like to give some welfare or something. So I think that the staff should draw some substance of this treatment, and based on our ED principles, you should devise some more operational principles or guidance, I hope. But anyway, so then, please.
I want to answer Henry's question. You said, if you look at IFRIC 15, really, if you look at the illustrative example, I think quite clear cut, you can have a continuous transfer. I think it's in IE3, IE8, and IE11. But having said that, that's actually examples, not the principle. If you look at IFRIC 15, you go back to the either you meet the IS11 or IS18. And within IS18, then whether is it a goods or a service, if it's goods, then if it's transferred continuously, then you can apply the percentage of completion. But the problem when you go back to IS18, I think paragraph 14, you have five criteria that you need to meet. I think really the problem that we have is really on paragraph 14b, where I think they say the entity retains neither continuing managerial involvement in a mouthful. What's that? You know, in a real estate industry, it's difficult. You know, the property developer don't actually manage it. You know, how do you satisfy that? And allow me to bring another point on the exposure draft, because I guess the perception now is really for real estate industry, you know, it's very difficult for you to apply the percentage of completion method. But I mean, I know that, of course, percentage of completion is not a God-given right, you know, accounting for real estate, it must be a percentage of completion. But the ED actually worked based on a different concept from IS11, IS18, and this ED, if it's the intention that the ISB board that you can still apply the percentage of completion provided there's continuous transfer, I think we urge the board to actually make it clear in the final standard. And I think it will be also good that perhaps there's some kind of discussion with the technical people of the Big Four or Big Six in the London office, because I think a lot of the other offices around the world may actually get back to them for their technical advice or whatever. And if, let's say, the London office say, oh no, you can't apply that, then it really defeats the whole purpose. And how to resolve that, I think the ED must make it clear and to do away with this perception that real estate, no more percentage of completion.
Okay, so, yes, please, Xiaoqian.
Thanks, Hatsumi. I just want to refer to Henry's comment. Firstly, on the IFRIC 15 questions, I think what it's causing a problem in IFRIC 15, it's kind of like we are seeing it repeated in example 17, and it basically relates to the indicators of control. The first indicator, basically, it's the customer's ability to specify major changes to the design or to the structure. And in a real estate industry, I think that it's impossible, especially in this region where you have multi-unit high-rise developments, it's not going to be possible for a single customer to step in and demand, you know, the design or the structure that he or she wants. That's number one. And the second factor relates to, you know, whether the customer at any point in time can take over the work in progress. Again, in a multi-unit high-rise, that's never going to be possible. You know,
And if you are, you know, if you look at all the other buyers, they will not allow that to happen. You know, at any point during construction, nobody can actually step in and say that, okay, I'm not happy with this constructor, I'm not happy with this real estate player, I just want to step in and basically take over, you know, change the developer, for example. So that those two indicators, I believe, are kind of like repeated in example 17, which I believe is causing a lot of pain to, you know, the construction industry in this region. And the second comment that I wanted to make, it basically relates to, you know, I mean, I agree with Henry that the concept of control, we need to look at it and connect it with the underlying that we're trying to control. Is that a service? Is that a good? Or is that a collection of rights? I mean, if you look at for goods, in the real estate industry, again, the fact is, even after the customer obtained legal title and physical possession of the apartment, the customer will never have full control of that apartment. And it goes back to the same principle that, you know, that customer is never going to be able to make changes to the unit. He can't change, say, for example, you know, the window of his unit from a rectangle shape, you know, to a circle shape, for example. You know, those are the basic things that he can't even change. So you know, I think it also depends on the underlying rights. We need to look at the underlying rights that basically has kind of like transfer, whether control of those rights has transferred from one party to the other party. And that brings me to my last comment on the fact that I think the ED currently assumes that transfer of the control is transferred from one single party to another single party, and it doesn't, you know, consider the implications of situations where the control is transferred from one single party to multiple parties, like in the real estate industry.
Okay, so shall we? Yeah, please.
I'll just run through the situation that we have here, which is actually, I believe, very similar in Singapore, except for certain legal framework, right? In the context of paragraphs 26 and 27, which I understand from lawyers, we actually did a chart to prepare a comparison between Malaysia, UK and Australia, and we find that it's extremely different, right? The thing is that in Malaysia, the entity, as in the developer, we have the right to utilize the progress payments. Coming back to Paul's concern about, is it just a matter of billing? No, because the payments must be supported by architect certification showing that work has actually been done. So in the case of multi-storey unit buildings, if we have, except for the original 10% and the foundation and footings, which is 10%, 10% each, if you buy a top floor level and the structure has not been built yet, you don't actually pay. So there has to be actual work done before, you know, so that is something concrete to that. Secondly, the instant we sign the sale and purchase agreement, as the developer, we lose the right to deal with the land anymore. It is truly buyer finance. The mortgage financier steps in. They acquire underlying rights to the property similar to the owner. And in fact, we even have a specific you know, provision in the sale and purchase agreement which has developed over time to improve buyer rights, to say that once we get an undertaking from the bank that they will pay the balance purchase price, we're even required to transfer title, so and they can deal with it. It's not just for financing purposes, right? And that points to the customer's right to deal with the underlying asset, selling, pledging, as mentioned in paragraph 27. The contract is effectively non-cancellable because there is no provision for cancellation by the customer in the contract. And the ownership of the work in progress in the event of liquidation, I mean, effectively, if the developer gets into trouble, the work in progress is not something that the liquidator has to refund. What they have to do is, you know, even if they were to find a white knight to step in to try to buy the development, the white knight will have to buy the development with the existing purchaser's rights intact. And if they negotiate at all, they negotiate with these people to either settle, take over, complete construction, all these rights are further protected by the Ministry of Housing that looks after the rights of house owners. So when you have something like that, you know, and coming back to Henry's question, why the problem with IFRIC 15, you can see that when it is fixated on indicators, there's a multitude of opinions there. And I think our situation is already so clear that we should apply the percentage of completion method. And, you know, bless the Singapore Accounting Standards Council, they were actually brave enough to come up with it and say that this is correct, right? But, you know, in that sort of a situation, you can still have maybe, you know, conflicting views when you are fixating on indicators. So what I would like to suggest, perhaps, is to do it this way. Again, if we say that percentage of completion method does result in useful information for users, could we perhaps have an affirmative statement that in the case of the real estate industry or the construction industry or any other similar industry, where the principles established by paragraphs 26 and 27, which is control in the sense intended, that you can direct, you know, prevent other people from using it, use or sell and pledge it, then the presumption is that the percentage of completion method is the correct method and not the other way around. Rather than, you know, if you have a situation with too many indicators, then we'll end up with a lot of arguments again. If it is stated in the affirmative that, in a sense, we're embracing back the concept of IAS 11, which has existed for a long time, and it must have served some useful purpose to users, but I appreciate what Paul says, we do not want to just have a time measurement, then just put a very low threshold, and then we'll stop all the rest of the arguments.
Thank you. So, Faiz, please.
Just an observation. It seems to me that talking to my colleagues in other jurisdictions, one of the difficulties in the real estate industry problem is that this is not a pure commercial contract. There is a lot of interference from the government, and that's really to protect the buyers, to the point where I would say the balance of power is with the buyers rather than the sellers. So that's why it's sometimes very difficult, perhaps, to come up with a commercially based principle of accounting, which doesn't recognize that in different jurisdictions there is a different concept of, you know, I wouldn't say interference, protection. Comparing the Singapore and Malaysian jurisdictions, there are terms which clearly no rational commercial person would agree to. I mean, for example, the developers are not able to stop the pledging of the asset. There's no such right. It was taken away from them. Now, in a commercial transaction, why would the developers, usually in a very strong bargaining position, willing to do this? Well, they weren't. It was enforced on them. There's a term in the Malaysian law that says if you can get five guys together to complain about the developer, you can change him. Again, that's a paternalistic override, not a commercial consideration. So I think that's the concern we have, that we understand our jurisdictions, and I think we don't have to do a detailed analysis to say that there are certain principles. One is that there is a degree of protection for buyers, which is more so than most other contracts, because this is retail. The second thing is, it's the government policy. We want to encourage sell and build because it's the fastest way of creating housing stock. And that is actually quite a key concern, particularly in emerging economies. The third principle, I think, is that when you look at the balance of powers, this irrevocability keeps on coming up. That's our test to ourselves that this is not a sham. Because if the contract is irrevocable, it gives you the sense that it will happen and therefore the buyer is protected because he's getting these rights. As opposed to one which I understand the US example can be broken at will. You just lose your deposit. That, I think, is why irrevocability to us is important.
Yeah, thank you for...